All right, let's begin. Perek Yud Zayin, we are up to Pasuk Zayin. We spent a little bit of time last week talking about we talked about the pestle itself and the buying of the pestle. So now I'm getting confused between Monday and Wednesday. Did we talk about the 1,100 coins, what happened to them, 200,
no,
900,
no.
How we got to
no,
that?
No,
oh,
yeah.
Oh,
no.
Oh, goodness.
We talked about
then we
the
are... Yeah, yeah, well, we'll come back to that. We're going to come back to that. But we didn't get to the... All right, so then let's go back to the beginning of the parak and read it through. A couple of loose ends there we'll tie up, and then we'll move on. Okay, beginning of the parak. Let's start again. So we may end up having one more class. We'll see. I seem to be further behind on Monday than I am on Wednesday. All right. I'm not quite sure why. It's usually the other way around. Vahi ish mehar Ephraim ushmo michayhu. So let's just stop here for a moment. And talk about the name. Do we do this? Do we talk about the name? Michayu, Micha? Do we end up with Michayu and Micha?
No.
Okay. Then we may end up with... You may get your wish after we may end up with one more class. We'll see. Shmo Michayu. Now we know later on his name becomes... Well, let's finish the paragraph. V'hi ish echad mihar Ephraim u'shmo Michayu. Certain person, gentleman, by Har Ephraim, by the name of Michayu, v'yomer le'imo, Elef umeya kesef asher lukachlach ve'at alit ve'gam amart be'oznai hine kesef iti ani lekachtiv. The 1,100 coins of silver that was taken, you swore, you took an oath, you cursed whoever took it, you told me about the curse, here's the money, I took it. Vatomer imo baruch bni la'ashem. Blessed my son to God. Why does she bless him?
Because he returns the money.
Partially. And the other reason?
Because she cursed him?
To cancel the curse. Uh-huh. Mm. So once she had already issued this Allah, so now she says, Baruch! Vayashev et elef umea kesev li'imo. He takes 1,100 coins of silver and he gives them back to his mother. Vatome imo, hakdesh ikdashti et kesev la'ashem miyadi livni. Lasot pesel lemasecha. So mother says to her son, when I was in the midst of this turmoil about having lost 1,100 coins of silver, I took an oath, and I cursed the person who stole it, but I also did something else, which is, I was makdish it. What does be makdish something mean? I designated it, set it aside for the purpose of something. In other words, you can be makdish. Traditionally, we makdish something for use for tzedakah or for Beit HaKabayit, which was the upkeep of the temple, or you makdish something to give it to tzedakah. She was makdish this money for the sake of her son, in order to make it into a pesel umasecha, an idol or some graven image, v'yata ashivenu lach, and therefore I will give it back to you. In other words, what's going on? Just storyline. What's going on? The mother said to Michayhu, when the money had been stolen, what did she do? She did several things. She cursed whoever stole it, put a curse on his head. Then, in addition,
she dedicated the money for a specific purpose.
Right. She sort of took, at the same time that she took an oath to curse the person who took it, she made a pact with God.
To make a covenant.
The pact with God was, you give me back this money, find the person, get it back to me, and I'll give it to Tzedakah. But in this case, it's not quite so simple, because she didn't say she'd give it to Tzedakah. She said she was makdish it to her son for the sake of making it into a pesel or masecha. V'yashev at the kesef li'imo, v'tikach imo 200 kesef atitneu latzoref. He returned the money. The mother took the money, took 200 silver coins, gave them to the silversmith. Ve'aseu pesel ma'secha v'hi b'vet Michayhu. Made it into a graven image and gave it to Michayhu for his temple. Pasuk hey, v'ha'ish Micha lo bet Elohim. This Micha had a temple, a house of God. He made himself some garments of priestly attire, utrafim, together with some kind of equivalent to the Urim V'Tumim of the Beit HaMikdash, Havdil, some kind of idolatrous soothsaying, fortune-telling mechanism. Pointed one of his sons as his Kohen. A phrase we will come back to later, beginning of next year. So a couple of issues. First of all, the whole chapter is written in this kind of satirical undertone. Right? This satirical nature of son stealing money from his mother, and his mother being makdish to God by making into an idol, and taking a nurse and blessing. And this, all, the whole thing is reeks of satire. And part of that is intentional. Part of that satire is because Tanakh off, you're getting a window into the world of pagan mentality. So a window into the world of how idolaters think. And from the perspective of the Navi, very rarely does the Navi paint the world of idolatry in rational light. The Navi will often paint it in satirical, exaggerated terms, because what you really want you want the people to understand how absurd the world of idolatry is all about.
But are these people Jewish or not Jewish?
Of course they're Jewish.
Too bad.
Of course they're Jewish. Ish Mihar Ephraim. Sons of Levi, the Nara Levi. No benefit of the doubt. No, this is not written to give them the benefit of the doubt. This is here to indict Klal Yisrael for. We've been reading this all year long, or the last 3 years. So this is all about Vayosef Lasot Hara B'nei Hashem. This is all about the idolatrous culture that has permeated B'nei Yisrael because they borrowed it from the world around them. That's what Sefer Shoftim is all about.
But what they're shocking about is how early we think it might have been taken.
Right.
Place.
When it's post, it's the first generation after Yeshua, but that's exactly where we saw it. Mm-hmm. Go back to Perek Bet. That's precisely where we saw it.
I mean, I guess even in the Chumash, when they had the whole thing with Pinchas and then.
True, but it's right there in black and white. We saw it in that generation. Let's just refresh our memories for a moment. Start with Perek Gimel. This is we wanted to suggest, according to the Gemara, that Pesach Micha is contemporary to Kushan Rishatayim or Otniel ben Knaz. So let's look at the beginning of the story of Otniel ben Knaz. Perek Gimel Pasuk Zayin. Beginning of Otniel ben Knaz. Ve'yasu b'nei Yisrael atara b'nei Hashem. Vayishkechu et Hashem elokayim ve'yavdu et ha'be'alim ve'et ha'asherot. That's how it starts. It starts with, that's the introduction to every story. They forgot God, and they started to worship Baal and Ashtoreth. Baal and Ashtoreth or Asherot are the local indigenous Canaanite deities, gods of fertility, gods of rain, and God was angry at them. So the only difference here is that whereas in Perek Gimel all it said is half a sentence, B'nai Yisrael started to worship idols, when you put it in those terms, sort of generic terms, you don't necessarily understand the depth of what that means, because we don't really have, especially in our context today, we don't really have an understanding of what the pagan world of idolatry was about.
But he's making Kohanim even.
That's nothing. That's like Kleinigkeit to the picture. Making a Kohen is a nothing in comparison. He's talking about Trafim. He's talking about Pesach and Masechah. The Kohen is irrelevant.
No,
it's
but I'm
like
saying
a minor
it's the whole scenario. It's not just
the issue here is we're talking about Pesel and Masechah. We're talking about idolatry. We're talking about real pagan idolatry. But that's exactly what it talked about in Perek Gimel and in Perek Dalet and in Hay and Vav and Zayin. The only difference is that here we get a sample of what it means. We haven't had a sample of what it means. All we've had is they worship idols. Who knows what that means? You know what that, I know what that means. We're getting okay. So now open up the door and open up the window, and suddenly we see what idolatry is about in this generation. It's real core idolatry. When Micha goes running after Bnei Dan in Perek Yochet, and he says to them, another satirical statement I've pointed out to you when we read it a couple of weeks ago, after they steal this pesel in order to bring it up to Shevet Dan, he runs after them and he says to them, Pasuk Chavdalad, Perek Yudchet, Pasuk Yudalad, Chavdalad. He says to them, Vayomer, Et Elohai Asher Asiti Lekachtem. Perek Yudchet, Pasuk Chavdalad. Et Elohai Asher Asiti Lekachtem. The gods, the God whom I have made, you have stolen. If you step back and think about what the concept of what God means and what it is, and the whole statement reeks of satire. Et Elohai Asher Asiti Lekachtem. There's a parak in Yeshayahu also that does a similar type of thing, where Yeshayahu wants to explain what idolatry is, and he talks about idolatry from the vantage point of the carpentry shop. The vantage of the carpentry shop. And he talks about taking a log of wood and cutting it in half, and over with one half he carves it, one half he throws into the fire and he cooks his dinner, and the other half he carves into an idol and he shapes it and he forms it and he puts it on his mantelpiece, and then he bows down to it and he says, God, you have made me. The irony, takes a log, chops it in half, one half he cooks his dinner, and the other half he worships. Because that's what the Nevi'im wanted to do. They didn't want to build idolatry up, they wanted to knock it down. They wanted to demonstrate how absurd it was, how illogical it was. Part of the challenge for us is because we don't live in a pagan world. We don't live in a world of idolatry. So it's hard for us to understand what its lure was, what its attraction was. It's a different conversation. But certainly I think that satire is evident in this brief description where you talk about the mother taking a curse, cursing the son who stole her money, the person cursing the one who stole the money. The money happened to be stolen by the son. So she says, fine, Baruch B'rini B'Hashem. Then she takes the money, she says, well, I can't take the money back. I was makdish it. What is I makdish it to? I was makdish it to you who stole the money, in order to make it into a pesel u'masecha, in order to make it into a graven image. So I'm going to give it back to you. But the whole thing is strange. And on top of that, we have this reference to, we have this ambiguity on the money. Just to add a little bit of satire to the story, we have this ambiguity of the money. How much money did Micha steal? 1,100 coins of silver. 1,100 shekel. Well, it says kesef, and I'm not sure what coinage it was, but 11 umea kesef. 11 umea kesef. When she goes to the smith, she takes matayim kesef vatitneu latzoref. She takes 200 coins and she gives it to the smith. So, on the face of it, what's wrong?
She has 900 left.
What happened to the 900? So take a look at the radak. I'll show you one possibility, and then I'll share with you an alternative. And you have the same source page that you have. If you don't have a copy of it, there are a few extras. It's the same one as last week. Same one as last week and the week before.
Do you have?
Yeah. It's Source number five, the Radak raises this question. If she gives 200 coins to the smith, what happened to the other 900? So the Radak says, "Imolak chamatayim kesef." His mother took 200 coins of silver. Unatanam latzaref, gave them to the tzaref, la'asot pesel l'masecha. Ve'amatayim kesef hayu schar hatzaref. The 200 coins was payment to the smith. Ubitshamiot kesef asad pesel l'masecha. In other words, the pesel is made of silver. So you take 900 coins, you melt it down, you make it into an idol. And you pay the smith 200. That's the Radak. The problem is, I think we discussed this. Mm-hmm. We did discuss this. Right? We did discuss this. The problem is that 200 coins of silver for a salary that is on average 10 coins a year is absurd. Yeah. So the alternative suggestion is that there was 200 coins made into the smith, into the idol, and the other 900 she pocketed.
We did talk about it.
Right. Why? Because the whole thing is satirical. Oh, the son stole from the mother. And then the mother says, oh, I'm going to give it back to you. So the mother was makdish it to her son, then stole 900 back from the son. Everybody's stealing from each other. You understand? The son stole the money from the mother. The mother stole the money from the son.
Oh, my God.
Trust fund.
All in the family.
she won't use the interest. She didn't.
For college.
That's right. So the whole thing is satirical. And on top of all of this, one of the clues to the world in which we're dealing with is the shift in Micha's name. We discussed the shift in Micha's name at all? Yeah. Michayu to Micha. Michayu to Micha is a very interesting shift. Right? At the very beginning of the story, he's referred to as Michayu, twice. Vahi ish mehar afrayim ushmo Michayu. And then again in Pasuk Dalet. ותיקח עמו 200 כסף ותתנהו לצרף ויעשהו פסל למסכה והיא בבית מיכהו. Now the next verse shifts focus. Up until now the vantage point has been the mother. So the mother whose son's name was מיכהו. Now פסק ה' ואיש מיכה לא בית אלוהים. So we have a shift from, not hard to figure it out. Shift from Michayu to Micha. What letters were dropped?
Hashem's name.
Yud and Vav. The Hey Vav ending was dropped. Why? It's not hard to figure out. Why was it dropped? And he will remain Micha for the rest of the story. But why was it dropped?
He wasn't godly anymore.
Right. Because names reflect identity. And it's not uncommon in Tanakh to have names that have Shem Hashem embedded in them. But when you do that, you reflect your religious core. You're idolatrous. You don't deserve a name like Michayu. So the name gets dropped. Now that's not uncommon. Very often we'll find in Tanakh kings, leaders who were identified as related to, as being part of this idolatrous culture, and at some point or another we find their names shifting. I'll give you a couple of examples. I put a couple of examples on the page just so you see where it comes from. If you take a look just above source 5 on this chart in the middle of the page, Micha or Michayu. On the right-hand side, you have a number of references. So, for example, Malachim Aleph Perek Yedaled is the story of the son of Rechavam. The son of Rechavam was Avyam. Vayishkav Rechavam imavotav yikaver imavotav b'ir David b'shem imon ha'amav ha'amonim ha'amonit vayimloch Avyam benot tachtav. So, in the lineage of Beit David, Rechavam is the king contemporary to Yeravam and Nevat when the kingdom splits. The next generation is a king by the name of Aviyam. If you look at the left-hand side, same psukim in Divrei Hayamim. You know that Divrei Hayamim and Malachim parallel each other, right? Divrei Hayamim, for the most part, Divrei Hayamim, bad parallel Sefer Malachim. Same psukim, Vayishkav Rechavam im Avotav Yikaver Be'ir David, Vayimloch Aviyah Benot Tachtav. So was his name Aviya or was his name Aviyam?
Yes.
Right, yes. And the answer is that they would often take on names that reflected a relationship or a connection to God, Aviya, and then the Navi would decide, and the authorship of the Nevi'im, they would decide that they deserved such a name. So Aviyam was, in Sefer Malachim, where he's described as a great idolater, his name is referred to as Aviyam instead of Aviya. Similar reference, for example, Malachim Bet Perek, next row, Malachim Bet Perek Chet, you have Melech Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat. Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat, also Melech Yehuda, also king in Yehuda. And if you look in Divrei Hayamim Bet, Vayakom Yehoram ha-mamlechet avi, vayitchazek viyaroget kol achav b'cherev v'gam misrei Yisrael. Yehoram was a nice guy, killed all his brothers to solidify his hold on the throne. He executed the rest of the royal family so there wouldn't be any challenge to his authority. And when he dies, it says, vayishkav Yoram im avotav. What happened? Dropped the hay. Doesn't deserve hay. One of the most famous is, of course, Yehoash. Malachim Bet Perek Yud Gimel, Bishnat Shaloshim V'Sheva, Shana Yehoash, Melech Yehuda, Malach Yehoash ben Yehoachaz al Yisrael B'Shomron, Yehoash, Melech Yisrael. Same Yehoash in Sefer Malachim, in the same Perek. Actually, that's Pasuk Yud. Next Pasuk, I just put on the left-hand column. But the next Pasuk, Vayas Hara B'nei Hashem, did evil in the eyes of God. He followed in Yavam's footsteps. So we went from Yehoash to Yoash, Uziyahu to Uziyah. It's not uncommon for these names to be shifted either in short form, but what often happened is the short form was a way of dropping Shem Hashem.
So in
the other way, it's interesting, the only instances we have where the stories are told of how the names are changed, we have by Avram and Avraham and Sarah and Sarah, where Shem Hashem is shared between them, or the hay is added to both of them, in fact, but you also have Yehoshua. Yehoshua's name change is an interesting discussion because it's not clear when it happens. Rashi assumes it happens in the context of Chet HaMeraglim. Other Mephoshim say that it happened much earlier because he's referred to as Yehoshua much earlier. But it's Moshe who changes his name. And there too, the significance of Moshe's changing Yehoshua's name from Hoshea to Yehoshua, to add Shem Hashem. I remember discussing this here at some point or another, what the significance of Yeshua's name change. Did we do this when we did the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua?
I think so.
I think we did. Because I think I shared with you then, not everybody was here with us at that time, but I shared with you then that according to the opinion that he adds his name earlier, when he first becomes his disciple, as a kind of loyalty to Moshe, or to loyalty to the teaching of Moshe, he adds the name of Shemesh of UK, there is actually an interesting... there's an interesting twist with Yehoshua, because Yehoshua is the first one officially who's given a name to that would include Yud and Hey together. Yehoshua. If you look at the beginning of it's Parshat Shavuah, so it's a nice segue. But if you look at the beginning of Parshat Bamidbar, look at the beginning of Parshat Bamidbar. There's an open seat. Suzanne, there's an open seat if you want to join us. Beginning of Parshat Bamidbar, but literally, Perek Aleph, you have a reference to all the names of the Nesi'im, the leadership of the various tribes. And if you go through those names, starting with Pasuk Hey, Ve'elishmot ha'anashim asher yamdu itchem. Le'uven Elitzur ben Shteur. Le'shumeon. Let's do it this way.
More intriguing if we can see it on the board. Somebody just read me the names by tribe. Reuven.
Elitzur ben Shteur.
Elitzur ben Shteur. Aleph or Aleph?
Aleph.
Next, Shimon.
Shlumiel ben Suri Shaddai.
Suri Shaddai.
Suri Shaddai. Reuven Shimon next.
Nachshon ben Aminadab.
Well, what's the tribe?
Yehuda.
Nachshon ben Aminadab.
Issachar. Netanel ben Suar with an ayin.
Zvulun.
Zvulun Eliav ben Chelon. Ephraim. Elishama ben Amihud.
Elishama ben
Amihud. Menashe Gamliel ben Pidatsur.
Gamliel ben Pidatsur.
Binyamin. Avidan ben Gidoni.
Avidan?
Avidan.
Ben Gidoni.
Dan. Achiezer ben Amishadai.
Achiezer ben
Amishadai.
Amishadai.
Asher. Pidiel ben Achan.
El ben
Achan. Gad.
Gad.
Eliasaf ben Deuel.
Eliasaf ben
Deuel.
El. Ryan.
And then Naphtali.
Naphtali.
Achira ben Enan.
Achira. Aleph Chet
Yod Reish Ayin.
Achira ben Enan.
That's it.
Okay. What's missing?
Levi.
Besides Levi. Levi didn't have an assid. Levi is a whole different category. He's not in the Mifkad of the army. What's missing?
Binyamin.
I don't know what tribe is missing.
Oh.
I mean, what's conspicuously missing from all these names? Well, Yeshua is not in the sea. What's conspicuously missing from all of these names?
Menashe?
No, Shem Hashem.
Okay.
There's not a single one with Shem Hashem in it.
They've all got Zuri
Shaddai. Oh,
Shaddai.
What they all have is some form of El or Shaddai. Correct? Shlumi El ben Zuri Shaddai. Or other forms of names. But Nitan El. Eliav, Elishama, Gamliel, Ben Betatsur, Achi Ezben Amishadai, Hagiel, El Yasaf. So you have some form of
reference
to either El, Sur, or Shaddai. Shem Hashem is not to be found. The first one to be given Yud Hey as a reference to connection to Shem Hashem is Yehoshua. That actually may explain, this we did when we did Yehoshua, that I suggested that this is an explanation, I heard this once from Rav Medad, an explanation to the very strange conversation between God and Moshe just at the beginning of Parshat Va'era, where Hashem says to him, Vayra lavotav. Vayra el Avraham el Yitzchak ve el Yaakov be el Shaddai, ushmi Hashem lo nadati lahem. I appeared to the Avot in the name of Kehel Shakai. My name Hashem, I did not make known to them. When the Mefarshim immediately point out that Shem Hashem appears to in all of Sefer Bereishit. So the one of the answers given is that there's a difference between the narration of Sefer Bereishit recording the fact that God's name is Hashem, and the mechanism or the methodology or the relationship between God and Israel, or the Avot being through the significance of the name Kel Shakai, which is a name that reflects God in nature. God is creator, God is the
the one who put nature in place. Kel means power. Shaddai means the one who created the world. But Hashem Hashem is a much more engaged name. It talks about God involved in history and the present sense of the term, meaning Hashem Hashem is the name that God uses when he wants to talk about God intervening in history, miracles, Shem Havaya. So the names of all of Bnei Yisrael up until that time all reflect their identity of God's name, namely Kel Shakai. Only post Moshe does the name Shem Havaya, Shem Yud Kevavke, come into play, and that's where Yoshua's name is. And from that point forward, the names are always, any name in Tanakh that has Yud He or Yud He in it, you assume is connected to this idea of loyalty or recognition of God. And so you have this guy, his name is Michayu. But the moment we identify him as an idolater, so conspicuously, the moment we talk about V'lo Beit Elohim, this guy having his own Beit Elohim, his own temple or house of idolatry in Pasuk Hey, suddenly his name shifts from Michayhu to Micha. Not an accident. It's exactly what I would expect.
But originally he was a man of God.
No, that's not what it says. His name was Michayu. It's a casual. It's like, how many people do you know with name Eliyahu? Right? Lots of people name Eliyahu.
But they could have just called him Michayu from the beginning.
Well, they could have, but then I would have. Then I wouldn't have a shear to give.
We wouldn't have a story.
I have nothing to say.
But then there was a good Micha also. I mean,
it's a different Micha. There's a Navi Micha.
Yeah.
It's a different Micha.
But I'm saying the name Micha isn't a bad name.
Neither is Michayu.
Michayu.
But when you talk about Michayu and then chop the name down to Micha, then you're making a statement.
It's a demotion.
Then you're making a statement. In general, names that have Shem Hashem embedded in them, it can be significant, not be significant. I mean, the fact that somebody, a parent, calls a child by the name doesn't necessarily mean that that's the personality of the child. But in some cases, yes. In some cases, no. But that's the story here with Michayu to Micha. It's a very dramatic shift. It's a shift in a moment where you have this phrase, Va'ish Micha lo Beit Elohim. The moment we chop off the Hey Vav at the end of his name, suddenly we see him with a temple. Va'ish Micha lo Beit Elohim. He's got a temple. And he will remain Micha till the end of the story.
Who just chops his name off?
The Navi. The Navi. That's who he's referred to. Whether it was a conscious decision or not, I couldn't tell you. But in the authorship of Sefer Shoftim, which is written by Shmuel Navi, that is what takes place. The other question that Chazal raised, did we talk about Shem Hashem in this Kodesh Chol? All the references to Yud Kei Vav Kei in this passage? The other reference, the other issue that's discussed in the Gemara, again, is part of this idolatrous culture. I see now why I had that extra shiur scheduled, because I was a week behind. Is that there's a few places in this paragraph where she talks about Hashem. Here you have this paragraph in which describes her in such pagan, idolatrous terms. And yet, she's talking about things that are very spiritual, in a certain sense. If you look, for example, beautiful. Baruch b'ni l'Hashem. That's a very religious sentiment. And then, v'yashav v'telef v'me ha'kesef l'imo v'tomer l'imo ha'kadei shiktashti et ha'kesef l'Hashem. I sanctified this money, I designated this money to Hashem. L'asot pesel l'masicha. So the mixture of imagery here is really quite remarkable. Lo v'ish micha lo bet Elohim, Beit Elohim, what is that? So Chazal has a fascinating discussion. When she refers to Shem Hashem, what is she talking about? Now, there is an interesting halacha. There are many places in Chumash where the word Aleph Lamed He Yud Mem appears. Many places in Tanakh. And we pronounce it like we would with Shem Hashem, with a kuf instead of a hey, Elohim instead of Elohim, because we assume it is referring to Hashem. But there are other places where we know it's referring to false gods, we know it's referring to idolatry, and so we consider it a Lashon Chol, we consider it not having any Kedusha, and we can pronounce it casually. So for example, in the second of the Aseret HaDibrot, Lo Yelecha Elohim Acherim Al Panai. Because there it's clearly, in context, a reference to other gods. There are, however, some places in Tanakh where the reference to Elohim is ambiguous as to whether it is Kodesh or Chol. And you're not quite sure. There's a third meaning of the word Elohim. In addition to being referred to either God or to idols, the third reference to Elohim in Tanakh can refer to judges. V'nikrav balabait elo Elohim. Asher yashi'un Elohim, beginning of Parshat Mishpatim, which Chazal understood as a reference to judges, people of power and stature. The end of Parshat Bereshit, where it talks about a very famous passage because it's somewhat controversial. Right before Parshat Noach. Perak Vav Pasuk Dalad. And the Nephilim ayu ba'aretz b'yamim ahem. The giants in that land were at that time. V'gam achrechen asher yavou b'nei ha'elohim el b'not ha'adam. A verse that gave way to all pagan culture and belief system of gods and demigods and what have you. But in the context, the simple explanation of asher yavou b'nei ha'elohim el b'not ha'adam v'yaldu lahem, giving birth to giants, right? Ha'nefilim ayu ba'aretz. Who were the Nephilim? Asher yavou b'nei ha'elohim el b'not ha'adam. So what are we suggesting? That the giants were the offspring of gods and man? As the Greeks tried to understand this phrase. What does it mean? That b'nei Elohim here means men of power and stature. Strong, El, strong, like judges, nobility, who started to give, to have offspring who were strongholding humanity and fighting with each other. And that ultimately is the segue into Vayar Hashem, Kidabara Atadam Baretz, that man was evil. Because it were the b'nei Elohim, the sons of the power mongers in the world, who were having offspring and taking over society. Depends how you translate the word Elohim. So, all of these references to Elohim as referring to either Kodesh or Chol or to judges, it's unclear. And then, the general understanding, in most cases, is that Shem Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei, in contrast to Shem Elohim, Shem Hashem is always Kodesh. It's always a reference to the proper name of God. Until you get to this passage. And suddenly we have this woman who clearly is idolatrous in mindset, being makdish l'Hashem pesel l'masecha. So the Gemara raises this question, a fascinating discussion, what exactly is she referring to here? If you take a look at the Gemara in Shavuos, Gemara in Shavuos says, Kol Shemot Hamorim B'micha Chol. Says, first opinion in the Gemara, any reference to God's name in the story of Micha is Chol, not Kodesh.
It's interesting to translate as secular. The English is not the right
secular,
translation.
Well, it means not Kodesh. I'm not quite sure how you translate Kodesh, but yeah. Rabbi Eliezer Omer B'micha Yesh Mehem Chol V'yesh Mehem Kodesh. Says Rabbi Eliezer, it depends. Some names are Chol, some names are Kodesh. Aleph Lamed Chol. Yud Hey Kodesh, which makes sense, right? Yud Hey Vav Hey is a proper name of God, so that clearly would be Kodesh, whereas Aleph Lamed would be Chol, with the exception of one reference to Aleph Lamed, which is Kodesh, and that's the last verse of the entire story, which describes Pesel Micha sitting up in Shevet Dan, Ko Yimei Heyot Bet Elokim Bishilo. That clearly is a reference. That reference to the Mishkan, which is Shemesh. So Rabbi Eliezer's opinion makes sense, but the first opinion of Tanakhama is really remarkable because what the first opinion is suggesting is that even the references to Yud Kei Vav Kei are Chol. I wouldn't even know how to pronounce it because we just have no frame of reference for what she's talking about. Lahavdil, it's like the witnesses. Where they took the name Yud Kei Vav Kei, they pronounced it literally, and they came up with the J witnesses. Generally speaking, we don't even pronounce it, although clearly it's Chol there, because clearly they transformed it into an idolatry. So technically, you could, according to this first opinion of Tanakhama, you could say it, but we don't. We just don't know what to do with that. But when she says Baruch B'ni La, she's talking about, you know, something equivalent in modern terms to the witnesses. You understand the reference to which I am talking. Mm-hmm.
People that come and walk by the
door. Right. They call themselves the J. We don't say the word, but it's just. It's,
why not?
It's why not? Because we just don't.
I just say it's hard to talk about things when you can't even call it.
Yeah, I know. It's right. It's true. But because we're just so. It's so ingrained in us that this name is such kedusha that we don't pronounce it. And here they turned it into the substantive foundation of an idolatry. Just the name turned it into an idolatry. Technically, I guess you could, but we just don't. But that's exactly what this first opinion says in the story of Micha. As you're reading it, and we're hearing this ambiguity, it says the one, there's no ambiguity here. This is pure idolatry from beginning to end. That's the world into which we are introduced. And then we're introduced to this Na'ar. And Chazal have a field day on who this Na'ar is and why. And we already gave you the punchline at the end of last week's shiur, which I did because I didn't want you to walk out of shiur last week with this kind of ambiguous perspective, but it was a little unfair of me because I gave you the punchline of a really dramatic build-up. But all right. Let's take a look at the next piece. In Pasuk Zion.
I know, it's driving me crazy.
There's something flying around.
It's a mosquito.
Huge mosquito.
Okay. So now we're up to Pasuk Zion. Vahi na'ar מבית מיכה, sorry, מבית יהודה, מבית לחם יהודה, ממשפחת יהודה, והוא לוי, והוא גר שם. Whoa. Let's do that again. והי נער, מבית לחם יהודה, ממשפחת יהודה, והוא לוי, והוא גר שם. וילך, we'll come to that. וילך האיש מהעיר מבית לחם יהודה, לגור, בשאימצא. ויבוא הר אפרים עד בית מיכה לעשות דרכו. Certain lad from בית לחם יהודה, from the family of יהודה, he was a Levi, who גר שם, lived there. וילך from בית לחם יהודה, he went to where? לגור בשאימצא, to go live somewhere. ויבוא Har Ephraim ad Beit Micha, lasot darko, and he gets to Har Ephraim to Beit Micha. Vayomer lo Micha mi ayin tavo, where are you from? Vayomer elav Levi, Levi Anochi, he says, I'm a Levi. What references? What difference does it make? I don't know. Mi Beit Lechem Yehuda, vaAnochi olech lagur b'Shemtza. There's three psukim. What do we know about this guy? Forget what I said to you last week because I want to work you through the process. So let's assume we're working off a tabula rasa and we're going to create. And we're going to create a tabula rasa right now. Here's a tabula rasa.
That's my mind right there.
And what do we know about this guy? So
he's coming from Beit Lachem. So
first of all, we know he's a Nar.
Okay.
What else do we know about
him?
He comes from Beit Lachem Yehuda.
Mishpachat Yehuda.
From Mishpachat Yehuda.
And he's a Levi.
The who?
Levi.
The who?
Gar-sham.
Gar-sham. Where's Sham?
Beit Lachem.
Beit Lachem Yehuda. Does not sound a little repetitive?
Yes.
Yes.
Veina, mi Beit Lachem Yehuda. Mishpachat Yehuda.
V'hu
Levi.
V'hu
Garsham.
We got it.
Okay.
Could use some editing.
This is Perek Yud Zayin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Vayelech goes on a journey. Mm-hmm. Where does he go on a journey? Vayelech from where?
Mi Beit Lachem.
Yehuda. And he goes? Lagur Vashemsa. Lagur. Where? Anywhere. Vashemsa.
But he found how to find.
Why does he leave Beit Lachem Yehuda? No idea. He's an itinerant Levi. Lagur, where's he going?
He
no destination.
No.
He's just going.
He's open.
He's a traveling soul.
Walkabout.
Luckily, he didn't find his way to India. Lost traveling soul. Okay, that's Aleph Bet Gimel. He comes to Beit Micha in Har Ephraim. Beit Micha says to him,
where are you from?
It's Zion Chet and Tet, actually. It's not Aleph. It's Zion Chet and Tet. Micha says to him, where are you from? So he says to him again, Levi Anochi.
Mi Beit Lechem.
Mi Beit Lechem.
Yehuda.
And where is he going?
Vani
Olech.
Vani Olech.
Vani Olech. Vani Olech. Lagur. Vashem. So, if I were to say to you, okay, let's work it through. What tribe is he from?
Yehuda.
Yehuda.
No,
he's
a Levi.
He's a Levi. How do you know? He says,
Levi.
Levi. Levi. Okay, no ambiguity there. Where's he from?
Are
you sure? Sure. No ambiguity there. How many times do I have to say that he's from Levi, that he's from Shevet Levi, that he's from Beit Lachem Yehuda, that he's
traveling?
That he's traveling. And he's traveling where?
Wherever he finds himself.
Wherever,
no particular destination. What's the Milat Mancha in these three paragraphs? There's many of them, but the one in particular? He's on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
Lagur. He wants to find new...
Where to live.
But lagur means to settle.
Right. He's journeying. He's holech lagur. He's b'ashem tza. So finally, he finds a place, which is, the Levi said, the Micha says to him,
stay here.
Stay. Ve'yomer lo Micha, shva imadi. From all of these lagur, he says, shva imadi. Settle. I found you a place. Very repetitive way to talk about a Levi from Beit Lechem Yehuda who makes his way, ve'yomer Beit Lechem Yehuda, and he happens to come across Vayavo ha-Ephraim. Correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Just to humor me, read the opening pasuk of Perek Yud Tet.
Vayhi bayamim ahem umelach in Yisrael, vayhi ish levi.
Ish levi.
Gar b'yarkitei har Ephraim. Ve'yikach lo isha pilegesh mi'Beit Lachem Yehuda.
So how many words should it take to describe a Levi from one location with a connection to another? Mishlevi, Garbi Arkatev Harafraim, Gilagish Mubed Lechem
Yudah.
So complicated? Vahina, Mubed Lechem Yudah, Mimishpachat Yudah, Vuhu Levi, Vuhu Gersham. Why couldn't it say, Vahi, Na, Vahi Levi, Mimishpachat, Mibet Lechem Yudah, Oh, Vayelech Levi, Mimishpachat Yudah, Vayelech Levi, Mibet Lechem Yudah, ויבוא הרפיים. וילך נא לוי מבית לחם יהודה, ויבוא הרפיים. Could have done the whole thing in this format, would have saved us a lot of space. I need four psukim to describe what I can in one. But clearly the answer has to lie in the fact that here, I don't care who this Levi is. He's never named in the whole story. He's the catalyst to the story of Pelegish Begiva. He's the evil perpetrator, but he's irrelevant to the story itself from a identity perspective. Whereas here, he na'ar, mibitlechem Yudah, mishpachat Yudah, v'hu Levi.
Drum roll.
His identity is important, and his lineage is important. Because what will become clear as the story unfolds, what we already saw, is the fact that he's a Levi is not tangential to the story. And here it's tangential. We don't care if he's a Levi. The fact that he's a Levi is irrelevant to the rest of the story. The only thing that's relevant is that he happens to be a Levi from Har Ephraim. You have a mix of two tribes. That's relevant to the story over in Perek Yotet. You have a mix of two tribes. That doesn't bode well in this period of history. In our story, the fact that he's from Har Ephraim or from Lechem Yehudah, headed to Har Ephraim, is irrelevant. What's relevant only is that he's a Levi. And he's moving, and he ends up finding his way to Beit Lechem Yehudah. Chazal picked up this tenor, all of these phrases, and they picked up another problem, which is, in addition to all of the issues related to the fact that he's a Levi from Beit Lechem Yehudah headed to Har Ephraim, so I have a mix of three tribes here. Levi, Beit Lechem Yehudah, headed to Har Ephraim. In addition to all of that, I have another mix issue, which is that he is a Levi mimishpachat Yehudah. A phrase here that doesn't fit.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Correct. What does that mean? How do you have a phrase that says you're from Mishpachat Yehudah v'hu Levi?
It doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make any sense, right? We actually had a similar idea back in the story of Shimshon.
Do with the parents.
Right? In which the Gemara suggested that you can have a tribal identification from both the father and the mother. Even though we don't... generally speaking, we identify tribal lineage to the father. That's because we live in a post-Talmudic conclusion age. Whereas pre-Talmudic conclusion, the Gemara entertains the question, where is lineage defined through both Jewish lineage and tribal lineage? The Gemara's conclusion, Jewish lineage aside, tribal lineage is generally from the father, but there is identification through the mother as well. And that's essentially the conclusion we came to by Shimshon, that even though his father is from Shevet Dan, his mother was from Shevet Yehuda. It's in the very same conversation in the Gemara about Shimshon that the Gemara raises the question about our friend. Our Na'ar. Take a look in the Gemara in Bava Basra, in source number 7. The Gemara raises the question whether or not lineage to the mother is called mishpacha, called familial relation or tribal identification. What about the pasuk? So the Gemara says, "Hagufa kasha." This pasuk is inherently contradictory. Amad v'hu Levi, alma mi Levi ati. Amad mishpachat Yehudah, alma mi Yehudah ati. He's a Levi, or he's mishpachat Yehudah. Can't have it both ways. So the only resolution is Levi davur mi Levi v'imim Yehudah. Elav davur mi Levi v'imim Yehudah. The only solution is that we have a split. We have a mixed marriage. His father is from Levi. His mother is from Yehudah, which explains why he's living in Beit Lechem Yehudah.
To which the Gemara says, not necessarily conclusive, because I'll give you an alternative reading of the story. Amar Rabba Bar Chanan, lo gavra de Shmei Levi. He's a Judean. He just happens to be given the name Levi. So Gemara says, wait a second, that doesn't work. Yehachi, why doesn't that work? You tell me why that doesn't work in the story. Right? That he's not a Levi at all. He's just called Levi. That's his name.
Because he never just says his name.
No, it does say his name. It says the name at the end of the story. We saw that. Right. Why is it so unacceptable in the story to suggest that his name is Levi? From the very, very beginning of the story.
Right, he's taken on to do the job.
Because Micha was so excited about this guy. He was excited not because
his name was Levi.
Lame is Levi. He was excited because he got a Levi as a coin. That's right. And that's exactly what the Gemara quotes. Says, but what about Micha? When Micha was so excited that he saw this as divine providence that he's got a Levi as a coin. So Gemara says, maybe that's what Micha was excited about, that he had a guy whose name was Levi. Maybe. So Gemara says, then come back to Janet's observation. V'chi Levi Shmo, v'yolo Yonatan Shmo. Shenamav Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. Hu v'nava yukohanim l'shevet Adani. His name is mentioned at the end of the story. We're told Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. So clearly, his name was not Levi. His name was Yonatan. Amarlei. Ulatamech. Wait a second. You can't tell me that that's proof that his name wasn't Levi, because that whole verse is ambiguous. Why is that whole verse ambiguous? When it says Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe, was his really name was Menashe? His name wasn't Menashe. V'halo ben Moshehu. It was really ben Moshe. He's really Yonatan ben Gershom ben Moshe. Dichtiv b'nei Moshe Gershom ben Eliezer. Moshe had two children, Gershom and Eliezer. This is one of them. Ela mitoch she'asa ma'ase Menashe tla'o akatub b'Menashe. So why is he called Menashe? Understand what's going on here?
Gemara has now suggested that Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe, as it's written, is in fact not Menashe, but in fact Moshe, which would make this Moshe Rabbeinu, this Gershom ben Moshe, and this Yonatan ben Gershom. To which the Gemara says, so then why is his name called, why is Moshe's name here referred to as Menashe? Don't worry about it, just a fly. Right, why is his
it's a
not a bee, it's a fly. Leave it alone and just.
It's a bee flying.
It's not a bee, it's a fly.
Because he did something wrong.
It's Ben Menashe.
It doesn't matter, it's not over here.
Why is his name called Menashe in this case, says the Gemara? Mitoch Sha'asa ma'ase Menashe. V'tichach. So Sha'asa ma'ase mitoch Sha'asa ma'ase Menashe tla'o akatub b'Menashe, because his behavior was Menashe isk. Who's Menashe?
New word.
Menashe was the king of Israel who was guilty of the worst idolatry in the history of Tanakh. Closed the Beit HaMikdash, executed all the Nevi'im, brought the Avodah Zarah into the Mikdash itself, closed the Mikdash, built himself an idol of Molech in the valley of Gibeon Hinom.
Shmuel did not know about Menashe when he wrote this book.
So that we'll come back to that second in a moment. But Sha'asam Ma'asem Menashe. So because he behaved like a Menashe, therefore, this idolatrous Levi who became the Kohen of Beit Micha, therefore, when we wanted to hide Moshe's true identity here in order to cover the connection to Moshe Rabbeinu, we used a name that was familiar to the identity of what's going on. So Gemara says, "Hachinami mitoch she'asa ma'asem Menashe, ta'atim miYehuda atlo akatu biYehuda." So that's the same answer. Really, he's a Levi. So why is he called Mishpachat Yehuda? Because his behavior was Menashe isk, Menashe by name, and Yehuda by tribe.
That's way to
Remarkable? Way too remarkable. And Ruth is right. Shmuel writes Sefer Shoftim. Shmuel had no idea who Menashe is, right? So which clearly means that according to this Gemara, the Nun
was added.
The Nun was added.
During the Talmudic period.
Right? But remember that all of Tanakh goes through an editing process of the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah, the days of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. And a little bit later.
But
so that's.
Couldn't Shmuel have had a Nebuah about what happened?
Could have. Less likely. More likely that it was. More likely that it was edited.
That's one way to
when it was written.
More likely that it was the Nun was added, which would explain why it's Talui, why the Nun is elevated.
Right.
It's the Nun that's added to the name of Moshe.
Because they didn't want to.
Quite possibly, Shmuel wrote, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Moshe. And at some point or another, they wanted to demonstrate the number one, that this Levi was, you know, fit the character profile of a Menashe, not a Menashe in Klai Yisrael.
And they
wanted to hide Moshe's identity, so they stuck the Nun in up like postscript. You know, you have a name like this, and somebody writes a Nun like that. If you look at every Tanakh, that's how it's written. It's written in a superscript, it's written elevated for that very reason. Now, the real question in my mind is where
did
Chazal. Just
goes to prove you can pick your friends but not your relatives.
Well, we're going to get to the relatives in a second. But just what is interesting is why did Chazal take it as a given that this Na'ar was Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson? That's really a remarkable thing. That this Na'ar is Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson. How did they come to that conclusion? If it's just on the basis of a Nun, then we're really in shaky ground, as they say, right? To build an entire theory that this Levi is, in fact, Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson because there's a Nun that's kind of elevated is quite astounding.
Yeah, doesn't have to throw it back in time. Chronologically, it's difficult.
And then it takes the whole story and puts it back in time. Once you're dealing with Moshe, so I showed you end of last week that there's a logic to that conclusion because the individual who is mentioned explicitly, without any ambiguity, is Pinchas. And these two stories are clearly contemporary to each other. They're written contemporary. They're written together. They're written with one structure by Mimahim and Melech B'Israel. If Pinchas is there, and Pinchas is certainly Aaron's grandson, then it stands to reason that the Levi could logically be Moshe's grandson. But I think there's far more to the identification of this Levi as Moshe's grandson than we have been heretofore able to uncover. So, we will have another class.
Oh.
Because we did not finish today what I wanted. So we will have one more class. And it will be, next Monday is Shavuos. Unless you want to do this as part of Shavuos, but I don't think that would be a good idea.
Not between 3 and 5 in the morning.
So we will have another class, B'zat Hashem, the Monday following Shavuos, which will be Monday the 4th, 2 weeks from today. And what I would like to do at that class, I'll tell you in advance already, is tackle two issues. Number one is textual. What textual evidence did Chazal see in the story itself that would lead them to the conclusion that this Levi is identifiable by name and in fact connected to Moshe Rabbeinu as Moshe's grandson, that this Menashe is in fact Moshe? So what textual evidence is there to link us to Moshe Rabbeinu? Is question number one. And question number two, which is far more important for us, is how did we go from back to Chumash? How did we get to a situation where Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson is an itinerant Levi journeying through because he's homeless and groundless and he's looking for a place to be anywhere. Lagur b'ashe yimtza. Now, think about it for a second. He's 4 kilometers from the Mishkan in Shiloh. He's 4 kilometers from the Mishkan in Shiloh. He gets to Harafayim and he ends up in Beit Micha. We're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson going anywhere he can find except Shila. How many times does it say Lagur ba'asher yimtza? I want to go live somewhere, anywhere, but there. And therefore he ends up in Beit Micha. How did we end up with Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson as the core of this idolatrous pagan story? So that's the real issue that I want to tackle, and Bezrat Hashem, we will have one more shiur to address this issue on Monday, June 4th.